We're going to begin this morning by reading the 17th chapter of Revelation. But first, I'm going to back up and read the last paragraph of the 16th chapter, because it goes together. It's kind of unfortunate that we have a chapter break here, because we really don't need one. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and out of the temple came a loud voice from the throne, saying, "It is done." Then there came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a severe earthquake. No earthquake like it had ever occurred since man had been on earth, so tremendous was the quake. The great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. Every island fled away and the mountains could not be found. From the sky, huge hailstones of about 100 pounds each fell upon men, and they cursed God on account of the plague of hail, because the plague was so severe. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came to me and said, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Then the angel carried me away in spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This mysterious title was written on her forehead, "Babylon the Great." She is the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who have bore the testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast, which you saw, once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. This is the meaning that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come, but when he does come, he must remain for a little while. The beast, who once was, and now is not, is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. The ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers." Then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw, where the prostitute sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the ten horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth." Well, that was simple, wasn't it? Not quite. I'd like now for us to share together a psalm which I'm hoping will reinforce the message that I have to share with you this morning. And the message is simply this: with all that the world has to offer us, with all the temptations that are there, and with all of the schemes that man has come up with for security and prosperity, if we would only put our hope in the Lord, and if we would keep him foremost in our minds and in our hearts, if we would seek him above all else, we would have everything that we need. Let's share Psalm 37 together as printed in the insert. Do not compete with evildoers, or be envious of those who do wrong. For like the grass, they will soon wither. Like green plants, they will soon die away. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will do this. He will make your righteousness shine like the dawn, the justice of your cause like the noonday sun. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when men succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not be vexed, it only leads to evil. For evil men will be cut off, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. A little while, and the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found. But the meek will inherit the land and enjoy great peace. The wicked plot against the righteous and gnash their teeth at them. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he knows their day is coming. The wicked draw their sword and bend their bows to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose ways are upright. But their swords will pierce their own hearts, and their bows will be broken. Better the little that the righteous have than the wealth of many wicked. For the power of the wicked will be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need a drink of water. I hope you don't make fun of me for this.
No.
Rubio's problem was he used the glass instead of a plastic bottle. We began our reading with the final verses of chapter 16, because it is here, with the pouring out of the last of the bowls of God's plagues on the earth, that we're introduced to a final character in the great war that Satan has been waging against God since the time of Adam and Eve. God remembered Babylon the Great, we are told. Babylon, the name, appears in 256 verses in the Bible, beginning with Genesis. So we see this is not something unique to Revelation. In fact, 156 of these mentions are in the book of Jeremiah itself. But here, in chapter 17 of Revelation, John gives us a detailed description of her and of the role that she plays in Satan's great war against God. Though the final battle of that war is yet future to us, the war is going on all around us, and we should be well aware of this combatant and her strategies, because I believe she is responsible for the death of more saints than anyone else, even more than the Antichrist himself. The angel has much to reveal about her. The most important thing we learn is that the woman bears the emblem of Satan's team. If you remember from a couple weeks ago, I spoke of God and Satan as being two combatants on a field. Of course, we know who's going to win the contest, but each side has its own emblem. God's side has the emblem of the lamb that was slain. Satan's side has the emblem of a beast having seven heads and 10 horns. Anytime we hear this beast mentioned, we know what team we're looking at. So we know which side she's on. This is the emblem of Satan and his chief representative, the Antichrist. The second thing we learn is the angel's purpose in telling all of this to John. You know, it's really nice when the Bible does this. Every once in a while it does. John, for example, at the end of his gospel, says, I'm sharing these things with you so that you will believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. At the end of 1 John, John says, I'm writing these things to you who believe that Jesus is the Son of God, that you may know that you have eternal life. And here the angel tells John, I'm showing these things to you so that you may know the punishment that is coming to this woman and what she represents. We must not allow ourselves to become so fascinated with the woman herself that we forget she's headed for destruction. Third, she sits on many waters, meaning that multitudes of people from a variety of nations will follow her. She is what we call a multinational organization or movement. We are not speaking of one nation. We are speaking of something that transcends national boundaries. Though according to verse 18, she is a city that rules over the whole earth, her rule is not political, but economic, as we see from the description of her wealth in chapter 17 and the effects of her destruction described in chapter 18. From her first appearance at the Tower of Babel, she represents man's attempts to build society apart from God. A society based on human effort, human intelligence, human ingenuity. An economy, a political system, even a religion that is totally man-centered and man-created. The original city of Babel was an attempt by man to create and ensure his own immortality. In their own words, to make a name for ourselves, instead of seeking their identity through the worship of God. God saw their efforts and understood that man was capable of achieving any goal he set for himself. But rather than being proud of this and encouraged by this, God realized that as long as man was estranged from him, any achievement would be tainted by sin and would only lead him further from God, and in the end would bring harm to both man and nature. So God scattered the peoples by giving them a variety of languages. We have almost overcome that curse and are almost back to the point where we would say of ourselves, there's nothing we can't imagine that we can't accomplish. And if we really reach this point, God will have no recourse except to destroy what he has created. Today we pride ourselves on technology and we boast if we can dream it, we can achieve it. Yet for all of our advances and the wizardry of our technology, we are still no closer to God. Our sin still separates us from heaven. And through the hand of the Antichrist, God promises to come down from heaven and again destroy the city that mankind is making for himself. It's a city where wealth and achievement only hides the misery of a people alienated from God. Babel was no friend of God, and Babylon is no friend of the church. In fact, she seeks to ruin the church because we are told she is drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs. She encourages us to trust in our own efforts, in our own accomplishments, in our own dreams, in our own inventions. If we can only be proud of our achievements and find value within ourselves, then we don't need to look outside ourselves to find a God who can give us meaning. The power of Babylon is human imagination. The promise of Babylon is immortality through our achievement. The pride of Babylon is the wealth that she creates. In Babylon, man worships himself, and wealth is the gift that he offers to himself. Just as the Antichrist is the leader of a worldwide empire, a political and military system opposed to God, and just as the false prophet leads a worldwide religious system opposed to God, so Babylon represents a worldwide economic system opposed to God. It is not capitalism or socialism or any other ism, but simply wealth itself. Because in no matter what economic system you have, wealth corrupts. From the time of Pergamum and Thyatira, countless Christians would trade the eternal values of God for Babylon's promise of wealth and comfort. Just compromise a little on your beliefs. Don't put them out in the public where they can be seen. Don't let them keep you from participating in all that the world offers to you. That's the lure of Babylon. Meanwhile, those fully committed to God, like the Christians in Smyrna and Philadelphia, would suffer disgrace and hardship at Babylon's hand. For God, wealth is a servant of faith, a tool that we use to help further God's kingdom and to bless others. But for Babylon, self is the god, and wealth is simply what we give to ourselves. But I said at the beginning that the angel's purpose in this vision was not to show us the wonder of Babylon, that's all around us, but rather to remind us of her fall and her punishment. Her fall comes at the hands of someone we've met before, someone we learn more about as we see his role in her destruction. She helps to bring him to power, and he returns the favor by bringing her down. He is the Antichrist. We are told that he was, is not, and will come up out of the abyss, which fits what we learned in chapter 13, where we were told that he had received a fatal wound but had recovered. His will be a counterfeit resurrection, a demonic imitation of Christ, to gain the adoration and obedience of the world. And it will work, thanks to the help of the false prophet. The seven heads, we are told, are seven kings. But then we're told that the ten horns are also ten kings. How can this be? The key is that the seven heads also represent seven hills or mountains. And in the Bible, hills or mountains are used to represent not just kings, but kingdoms and empires. The angel tells John of seven empires, five of which have fallen, one of which is, and one that is yet to come, and when it comes, will remain only for a short time. Of course, the world has seen more than seven empires, from ancient China to the British Empire and even our own role as the world's only superpower. But the Bible speaks of seven specific empires which have a unique role as oppressors of the people of Israel. The first is Egypt, which oppressed her before she was born. The second is Assyria, which destroyed the northern kingdom. The third is Babylon, which destroyed the southern kingdom. Then Persia, which destroyed Babylon and continued to oppress God's people. Then Greece, which continued to oppress God's people. That's the five kingdoms that were: Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and Greece. The kingdom that was, is the kingdom that is for the angel and John, is the Roman Empire, which existed when this book was written. The one final kingdom was the kingdom similar to Rome that would arise at the end of time. We are told about him in the book of Daniel. Yes, other kingdoms have come and gone, but these seven have a special place in the history and the future of Israel. The fact that the Antichrist is an eighth king that belongs to the seven simply means that he is leader of a nation, but will eventually become a leader of the entire world. An example of this would be a British or American or a Muslim ruler who rules a nation, like Britain or America or Saudi Arabia, but then is promoted to leader of all nations. Would be similar to whoever gets appointed the chief of the United Nations if the United Nations had the power of a world empire. He belongs to one country, but he ends up ruling over an empire. This leads us to the ten horns, ten individual rulers who will come together in order to give the Antichrist the right and the power to rule the world. Though his reign will last only a short time, it will be an extensive reign. Just as we see Congress allowing and even asking and pleading with the president to do things that the president alone should not have the power to do, so world leaders will do with the Antichrist. As we get closer and closer to the time of the end, the masses will long more and more for a powerful ruler who will take responsibility and rule with conviction and authority, because they will see the world as such a dangerous place in need of someone who is able to promise them security. The world wants a leader, even a dictator, and the morality of that leader doesn't matter as long as I have food to feed my stomach with. Friedrich Nietzsche, a 19th century philosopher who rejected both God and Christ, said that the time had come for the world to set God aside. God is dead, he gladly proclaimed. And in God's absence, man would look for and would accept the rule of an Uberman, a Superman, who would promise to lead the people if only the people would be completely submitted to him. A scant 25 years after Nietzsche's death, Adolf Hitler lived out to his prediction and brought the world to the very brink of self-destruction. The next such ruler will take us the rest of the way. And one thing he will do, as we see here in chapter 17 of Revelation, will be to attack the very economic system that brings him to power. Now, let me speak very carefully here so I'm not misunderstood. I cannot say who this person will be, but I can point to examples that illustrate different details of these end times. Just as the reign of Adolf Hitler provided a model of certain aspects of the Antichrist and his rise to power, so too our current political situation illustrates some of the details of today's chapter. Our current president has expressed a hatred and a supposed moral outrage for our current economic system. Just as Hitler wrote of his hatred for the Jews and then lived it out through the Holocaust, so Obama has written clearly about his hatred for our country's history, its constitution, and its economic system. And in his first years in office, he has carried out simply what he stated in those books. People are surprised at some of what he's doing, but I really don't know why. Because he told us what his attitude was, what his values were, and what his goals would be. He is systematically trying to dismantle our nation's economy, which he regards as evil and unjust. And he's trying to replace it with a system which would be 10 times worse, a system of redistribution that has led nation after nation to the brink of moral and economic bankruptcy. This is one example of a world leader hating and attempting to destroy an economic system that helped to bring him into power. On 9/11 of 2001, we saw another example, as the Twin Towers of New York City were brought down by an attack that specifically targeted them as symbols of a world economic system that they saw as demonic and hateful. The very system that makes their nation rich through the sale of crude oil, they deliberately brought to its knees. For them, Babylon, the city that rules over the kings of the earth, is New York City. I personally believe that when all is said and done, 9/11 and the rise of radical Islam and our current administration will be seen as tools that God has used to bring about the events that are described in Revelation chapter 17. If I'm right, then the time is not far off. As the angel said, God put it in their hearts to accomplish his purpose. And because I believe that no president or world ruler is able to have authority apart from the will of God, I must believe that the fact that Obama has been elected twice is simply evidence that God has decided it's time for our nation to be punished. If any of you are thinking that the world economy is corrupt and should be destroyed, you must understand this, that any economic system run by sinful human beings will itself be sinful, because wealth is a power like political power, and it corrupts leaders regardless of what system is in place. Democratic power is corrupting Obama as surely as fascist power corrupted Hitler and communist power corrupted Stalin. The same is true when it comes to economic power. Our economy leads people to sin, but it also serves God's kingdom. And there is no other economic system that will be any more just or any more kind. Certainly not the socialism envisioned by our president and half our legislators. A socialism that has been responsible for the shedding of more Christian blood than any religious or political system the world has seen. I'll close my sermon this morning simply by reading about the destruction of Babylon in chapter 18. It's a graphic description of the downfall of this great worldwide economic system called Babylon the Great. Three times we will hear the refrain, "In 1 hour your doom or ruin has come." I heard this refrain from people on 9/11. In 1 hour, the towers fell. That destruction was only God trying to wake our country up. It didn't work. But that was only a warm-up. The main event is yet to come. In the midst of the destruction come two things you should pay special attention to. First, what brings woe and distress to those on earth brings joy and rejoicing to those in heaven. And second is the call of God to his people to come out of her so that you will not share in her sin or receive any of her plagues. How do we come out of her? By keeping our eyes on Jesus and trusting in God and not in our own creativity. By using wealth as a tool, not being used by wealth as a master. Do we think the disasters described here cannot happen? Think again. They have happened, and with amazing frequency in the past 20 years. Like birth pangs, they are getting more frequent and more severe. First in the 90s, the dot-com bubble burst, bringing recession. Then in 9/11, the towers fell, bringing another round of tough economic times. In 2008, the housing bubble burst, leading to a recession we still have not come out of. All of a sudden, in a moment, trillions of dollars disappeared. What will the next bubble be? The bloated student loan market? Our $16 trillion debt? The coming sequester? Some other policy of our elected officials? Do we still doubt that the catastrophe of Revelation 17 and 18 could happen? We must open our eyes. Will we still trust in wealth to rescue us? Over and over we hear of the need to invest in gold as a hedge against tough economic times. Well, the whore Babylon is drinking from a golden cup, and yet she will fall, and she will bring the world with her. Will you still trust in gold, in the stock market, in schemes, in investments, in leaders who want all wealth except their own, of course, to go to the state for redistribution? All economic systems will eventually fail, as they did in ancient history, bringing the Roman Empire to an end and ushering in 1,000 years of dark ages. Yet now as then, God offers an investment plan that has proven not to fail. Put your trust in Him. Invest your whole being in His way of living. Store up treasures in heaven where markets don't collapse. No, money is not evil and wealth is not demonic. Using the wisdom God gives you to be a good steward of your resources is not being unfaithful. But when money rules our thoughts, when we get the gold fever, when building a fortune distracts us from seeking God and knowing God and submitting to God, then we too become victims of the demon mammon represented by Babylon. Wealth for the sake of wealth. The love of money that leads to all kinds of evil as it crowds out all other loves and replaces all other duties it might have. As it did for Jesse Jackson Jr., of whom I heard it said this past week, he sold his soul for a Rolex watch. That's the way gold operates. The truth is, no economic system will be God-serving until God rules in the hearts of the people who use it. Every economy is simply a tool to be used by God's people for God's kingdom, or to be used by those who don't love God to pull people away from God. Now listen, as in 1 hour, on a day perhaps not far off, the world's economy will intentionally be destroyed, and its destruction will affect every person living on the earth. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, "Fallen! Fallen is Babylon the Great! She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird, for all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxury." Then I heard another voice from heaven say, "Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Mix her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. In her heart she boasts, 'I sit as a queen. I am not a widow. I will never mourn.' Therefore, in one day, her plagues will overtake her. Death, mourning, famine. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. When the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her. Terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, 'Woe! Woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power! In 1 hour, your doom has come.' The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk and scarlet cloth, every sort of citron wood and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron and marble, cargoes of cinnamon and spice, of incense, myrrh and frankincense, of wine and olive oil, of fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and the bodies and souls of men. They will say, 'The fruit you longed for is gone from you. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered.' The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, 'Woe, woe, O great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. Every sea captain and all who travel by ship, the sailors and all who earn their living from the sea will stand far off. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, 'Was there ever a city like this great city?' They will throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning will cry out, 'Woe, woe, O great city, where all who had ships in the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour she has been brought to ruin. Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints, apostles, and prophets, God has judged her for the way she treated you. Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea. He said, with such violence, the rich city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. The music of harpists and musicians, flute players and trumpeters will never be heard in you again. No workman of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone will never be heard in you again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. Your merchants were the world's great men. By your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. In her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been killed on the earth. Heavenly Father, help us to keep in mind the final outcome of all things. In your Psalms, the psalmist will so often say that when he sees the prosperity of the wicked, he wonders if he hasn't been wasting his time by trying to be righteous. But then when they consider the final end of all people, they are reminded that anyone who forsakes your way is headed only for destruction. There is no wonderful outcome at the end where everybody gets exactly what they wanted and we all live happily ever after. You have clearly told us the way that leads to life and the way that leads to death. Give us clear eyes to see the path of life and help us to walk that pathway of life in the light of your truth and your love. Through Christ we pray. Amen.